Thanks a lot. It's really a great pleasure to be in these seminars with you. I hope you're seeing my full screen. Yes, perfect. Great. So so in this talk, I'm going to try to give like an overview of what I think is going to be relevant for next generation detectors, and in particular for doing cosmology and fundamental physics. I will divide the talk in three different parts. And please don't hesitate to ask questions during any point of the talk, but also I will make like some breaks within these parts where you can, but it will be easier for you to ask questions. Right, so this should be changing the slide. So you, I mean, I'm sure you're all aware that now we have like really like a large set of binary black hole detections, but we have also observed binary neutron star black hole mergers more recently. This sets a really fantastic catalog to understand and study astrophysics, and this is really, really exciting. But for this talk, I want to focus more on how we can use these compact binary coalescence as tools to learn cosmology. And the first instance of that is, of course, 17OE17, the binary neutron star merger, which was also observed with electromagnetic radiation and gave us the first standard Siren measurement of H0. This is just hinting about the beginning of what we will be able to do in the future. And to get a sense of what we will be able to do in the future, I like to summarize this in these two diagrams. So on the left, you have the number of detections as a function of time. And on the right, you have the horizon redshift, so how far you can see with your detectors as a function of the total mass of the binaries. So essentially, like this, the total mass comes from the frequency range of your detectors. So right now, with the first two observing run and the first half of the third one, we have about 50 detections that will come when we have the full third observing run around 100. So this is our situation, and we are seeing binaries which are below redshift 1. Now, within the current technology, in the next two observing runs to arrive at LIGO design sensitivity, we will start to move to hundreds and thousands of detections, and we will be able to see sources which are around redshift 1 or a bit lower. But then like there will be like a dramatic change when we move to the next generation of detectors, that is what is known as a 3G detector, third generation, which are ground-based detectors, which are planned to be one in the US, Cosmic Explorer, and another in Europe, Einstein Telescope. And there will be also LISA from space, which will be complementary because it will be probing the millihertz region. So you see that with third generation detectors, we are in the regime of hundreds of thousands, and if we are lucky, maybe millions of detections as they accumulate. And you see also on the right that with Einstein Telescope and Cosmic Explorer, you can really reach essentially all the binary black holes that have merged within the history of the universe and that have an astrophysical origin. So this is really, really exciting if you want to do cosmology, because then you are accessing the high redshift universe. And moreover, with this better sensitivity, we will obtain higher signal to noise, which is really interesting if you want to do a test of gravity and if you want to see deviations from your signal. Moreover, as the network of detectors increases, now we have two in the US, one in Italy. There is CAGRA that joined, but will be fully joining in the next observing run. And there is also plan to have one detector in India. So you see like the network is increasing. And with this, you can also localize better, improve the polarization. And I think polarization is something which will play a key role also for test of gravity and to break degeneracies in parameter estimation. So in the talk, I will focus in three parts, and I will cover some of the research that I've been doing recently. Let's start with the part of cosmology. So when a binary coalescence merges, then you emit a gravitational wave, and this gravitational wave travels across the universe. And essentially what will happen to this signal is that it will decrease its amplitude just because it's an spherical wave whose amplitude decreases with the inverse of the luminosity distance. And it will also get stretched because the universe is expanding and you have you received the signal. So when you go to your detector and see your signal, essentially you are sensitive only to luminosity distance, which comes from the inverse of the amplitude and redshifted masses. If you want to do cosmology, the simplest thing, of course, is to focus on the luminosity distance, because this depends on the expansion rate on the Hubble parameter. But then, of course, the question is, how can you get the redshift? So, because gravitational waves directly don't provide that information. So if you see a counterpart, like in the case of 17-17, that's fantastic, because then you can measure the luminosity distance, you know the redshift, you constrain the cosmological parameters. Now, to have an electromagnetic counterpart, you need to have some matter around your binaries. And this essentially implies that you need to have some neutron star around. There are now these possible claims that also if you have a binary in the AGN disk, you could also have counterparts that you identify. But in most scenarios, standard scenarios, you need a neutron star. And we know from observations that binary neutron star mergers and neutron star black hole mergers so far are less frequent. And then there is also the question of, if you try to go to higher redshift, will we be able to identify a bright counterpart for our sources? So these are some of the challenges for the bright side and approach. But people have also worked out alternatives. That is, you can obtain the redshift not directly identifying a single counterpart, but you can use a galaxy catalog and say, okay, within the error box of my localization, I know that in this galaxy catalog are X number of galaxies. I can statistically infer the cosmological parameters saying that my binary black hole comes from one of these galaxies. And there are examples from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration of doing this analysis in collaboration with the Dark Energy Survey. Now, for this type of what people call dark siren technique, you need to have very good localization errors, because you want a small region where there are few galaxies, and you also need to have complete catalogs, because then if you don't have complete catalogs, you are introducing some bias in your inference. So it's interesting also to think of alternative to these two methods. And before going to the particular alternative that I'm going to explain, it's important to remember also that when you fix your theory of gravity, when you fix your cosmological model, then directly from the signal, you can translate the luminosity distance and the redshifted masses to redshift and masses. So I see there is a hand up from Subhadip. I'm fine.
Right, Jose, so this is regarding the statement regarding completeness. So I mean, completeness one can still avoid, right? Because if you do cross correlation with the gravitational sources and galaxies, your completeness is really not required. You can basically miss all the possible host of the gravitational sources and still get the good measurement of the cluster formation.
But I believe what it will be challenging is first to understand well, like all the galaxies you're seeing and the ones you're not seeing. And also you have to be, I mean, if you want to reach like high redshift, I'm not so sure how many catalogs we will have that could give like a complete survey of.
And I understand. I mean, if you combine Daisy, Sphere X, Euclid, you pretty much go up to the horizon observable from LIGO.
Sorry. Yeah, so the key point, so the key point is that the actual host galaxy containing the LIGO source does not need to be in your galaxy catalog. All that you need just is that there are some galaxies somewhere spanning the range of redshifts over which your mergers exist.
Right. Okay. So, right. But just, sorry. Yeah. So this is, you're talking when you're doing the cross correlation right now.
Right. But that dominates the signal, right?
I'm not so sure. I don't know.
Oh, well, yes, yeah, so we can talk about this afterwards. But it's a very simple calculation. You can show that, you know, the two-point correlations are dominated not by the actual host galaxies, but instead by the neighboring galaxies.
Okay, that's interesting. I haven't done that calculation. Yeah, but I'll be happy to discuss more about this later. Thanks.
I've told Daniel this several times. It's funny. Okay, sorry. Yeah, anyway, go on.
I like to, to have questions during the talk. So that, please keep doing it. So I was saying that if you fix your cosmology, then you obtain redshift and masses, and that's what LIGO and Virgo do all the time to infer the properties of the astrophysical properties of your population, such as the merger rate history or the mass distribution of your events. So now, what you can do is that you can combine this astrophysics analysis and with the cosmology analysis and do both at the same time. And the key here is that you are sensitive to redshifted masses. So if you were to know, or if you were to identify relevant scales, mass scales in your mass distribution, then as you observe your binaries, if you observe this mass scale at different luminosity distance, then you can infer the redshift just from this simple formula. Of course, you do this in a Bayesian framework. This is kind of like the simplified version. But we know, and we've seen already some of these features in the mass distribution, and one of those comes from what is known as the peristability supernova gap, which predicts that you cannot form a black holes within a certain range, because then you will trigger an instability that will eject part of the material, and you will not be able to form heavy black holes. So this is a process which only an instability that only works in a certain range, and that is why it's called a mass gap. So so far, within the latest LIGO-Virgo catalog, what this has been shown is that only a really small percentage of the events, about a few percent, have masses which are above 45 solar masses, which hints that at least this seems to be consistent with the theory of peristability supernova gap, which predicts that around between 40 and 50 solar masses, there should be a decrease in your number of events. This is not to say that some of the events could not come from other channels, like hierarchical mergers, et cetera, but at least the data shows that there is a relevant decrease in the number of events. So what we ask Dan Holt and myself is that, okay, if we are seeing now the lower edge of this peristability supernova gap, it could be possible that there will be also a population on the other side of the gap, what we call the far side black holes. So you could also use this population above the gap to do the same exercise to obtain information and constraints on cosmology. So far, we have not detected black holes above the peristability supernova gap. Well, there is 19.521 that, depending on which priors you use, you might end up with one of the binaries above the gap, but let's forget for the moment about that. You can use the constraints on the fact that we are not observing black holes above the peristability supernova gap to see, you can use these upper bounds on the number of detection and see, okay, as we improve our sensitivity, how many events we could detect. And this is precisely what is plotted on the left panel on this slide. So this is the upper bound on the number of events as a function of the total mass. And here we have different detectors. You can notice that that, for example, for design sensitivity, which is A plus, which is the orange line, you could have like tens, if we are lucky, hundreds of events. With Lisa, for example, you see that there is this clear rise in the number of events that comes from the fact that Lisa is mostly sensitive to low frequencies. So you, as you increase the masses, is where you are most sensitive to. Anyway, one of the interesting things of this analysis is that, for example, if you ask like how many of these events that are seen by Lisa will be seen then by ground-based detectors within 10 years. And then that this is what we call the fraction of multiband events. And here we have, again, the plot as a function of the total mass. So you can see that for total masses below 100, that is the typical binaries that we are seeing so far, then it really doesn't matter which ground-based detectors you have because you are limited by the sensitivity of Lisa. But then as you move to higher masses, then Lisa does a better job, and then you are limited by the low frequency sensitivity of the ground-based detectors. Now, what is interesting is that you see that the fraction of the events it really increases with the mass. So if there was this population of far-side binaries, it will really be a key target for multiband events with Lisa. And so we did also the exercise of asking like how well you could constrain the expansion rate using the edge of the pre-instability supernova gap for these far-side binaries. And the results on the constraints on the expansion rate are on the left as a function of the minimum mass of the population. So essentially what we are doing is we are saying, okay, starting from a given mass, we will have this population. We don't really know where this mass is going to start. And then so let's move it around. And then of course, as you move it around, for example, it's clear for the case of Lisa, which is the red band. Again, as you move to higher masses, you do a better job in constraining the expansion rate. In any case, we don't find that the constraints are particularly competitive with other type of analysis, because you see that for Einstein telescope, you always are in the range of a few percent, which is a bit larger than other sources. But what is interesting is that with these binaries, you are accessing like different redshifts. So on the right, this is the mean detected redshift for the population. And you see that with each of the detectors, you can get, you are probing the expansion rate at very different redshifts. With Lisa, typically around redshift of 0.4, but then with Einstein telescope, you can move to higher than one. So I see two hands. I don't know who was first.
Oh yeah, sorry. So it's probably the same question. Sorry. So I might have missed on this slide, but did you mention? I mean, like, you know, so to make this measurement across different redshifts, is the assumption that this parent stability feature does not evolve with redshift?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Yes. So in this analysis. And in something that I will talk later, I'm assuming that the mass distribution does not evolve with redshift. This is an active area of research now. There is like, I think this week there was a paper, I forgot the first author, precisely searching, analyzing how much the mass distribution evolves with redshift. What I can say is that we don't expect the evolution of the mass distribution to be completely degenerate with the cosmological evolution. So if you want, we know really well how, not really well, but for lambda CDM, you know how the mass distribution should change as a function of redshift because you know the shape of the luminosity distance. You know analytically the form as a function of your cosmological parameters. So having a mass distribution that is degenerate with that particular shape of the cosmology is not trivial, and that's something that we are working currently here at Chicago And we hope to have results soon, but I don't have things to present at the moment for that. But this is an excellent question, and it's an assumption that I'm making here, and I will be making also later. Okay. And I assume.
Right. Yes. No. Okay. Like, but to make this assumption, I guess then you have to assume, you know, that this parent stability doesn't depend on, like things like metallicity, for example.
Yes. Because, yeah. Okay. To clarify, the expectation, at least from the population models, is that it is not going to change like dramatically. I mean, so it will change mostly at high masses. When you are more sensitive to the metallicity, and you could form higher black holes, but in some sense I've been oversimplifying the picture. I was saying like you focus on the peristability gap, but at the end what you really care is the full shape of your mass distribution. So you are really asking how does my mass distribution change at different luminosity distance beam. And then what cosmology tells you is that you are only going to shift your mass distribution. But then astrophysics could tell you, okay, you can also change the shape of your mass distribution. So I think there is more leverage, like to identify mass evolution, because you are really, if you are seeing a change in the shape of the full distribution. But I'm neglecting that there is evolution due to metallicity.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Well, that's a fantastic question. And something that I wanted to mention as well is that there was very recently also a paper which used far side binaries, but focus on multiband events and the dark sided method. And they obtain constraints which are, I think, according to their numbers, a bit better than the ones presented here. So just also that you are aware. Okay, so this was the first part on cosmology. There was a bunch of questions, but if there is any other, I'm happy to take it now. If not, I will continue and I will move to what we can do to test gravity. And I will be thinking mostly on test of the propagation of gravitational wave and testing gravity at cosmological scales. So the nice thing of general relativity is that it makes like really concrete predictions about the things that we should observe. So in particular, it tells us that the gravitational wave propagates at the speed of light. It tells us that the amplitude scales inversely with the luminosity distance. It tells us that there is no dispersion across the propagation. And it tells us that there are two tensor polarizations that they propagate in the same way. So despite the fact that when you start to explore like a modified gravity, it's really like a huge landscape. And there are so many possibilities. And this diagram is not even complete. And I don't intend to explain it, but the point that I want to get across is that by testing each of these predictions of general relativity, you can probe different chunks of this modified gravity landscape. And an excellent example was, and probably the simplest, was the prediction of the speed of gravitational waves, because general relativity tells you clearly that it should be equal to the speed of light. And then we have this amazing multi-messenger event, which where the gamma ray bursts arrive only 1.7 seconds later the gravitational wave. And then you put these magnificent constraints on the speed of gravitational waves. So this constraint by itself already kills a large section of this parameter space, models of modified gravity trying to explain dark energy. But you can do more than you can do more than just using multi-messenger events. And in particular, you can test, for example, the prediction for the luminosity distance. So the luminosity distance in general relativity of gravitational wave is equal to the one of electromagnetic radiation. And you can test if this is the case doing a population analysis as the one as I was explaining before, for the cosmological parameters. So to do this exercise, what I'm going to focus is I'm going to particularize to the case in which the modification of the luminosity distance follows the energy density of the dark energy. And then there is only one parameter, Cm, which is in this formula here, one dimensionless parameter, that tells you if, as the gravitational wave propagate, they amplify you amplify the signal or you dim the signal. So whenever Cm is positive, the additional fields of your gravity theory are acting as a friction term. So the amplitude decreases and the luminosity distance, which is inversely proportional, increases. So you see when you go to green, you increase the ratio, which is different from one as a function of redshift. And then the opposite happens. If you have negative Cm, then you are amplifying your signals as the gravitational wave propagate. And these are the blue lines. Now, there is the constraint from 17.017. You can use this data point to constrain this relation. But notice that 17.017 was a very close binary, which was at redshift 0.009. So this will be almost on the edge of the left edge of the x-axis. So you see that you are not very sensitive to these cosmological modifications because they become really important when you move to higher redshifts. So of course, if you are changing the luminosity distance relation, you are changing how many black holes you see and at what redshift you see them. So this is the plot of the detected black holes for a simulation as a function of redshift. General relativity is the black line. And then if you have like positive CMs, if you are adding additional friction, you can only see, since your signal is dimmer, you can only see events which are closer. So you see that the green lines, the peak of the green lines, move to a lower redshift. And the opposite happens when you are amplifying the signal, then you are able to see farther and farther away. And you can if you have a large deviation, you could almost see like all the black holes which are merging. Now, because we infer the source masses from using the luminosity distance, the relation with the redshift, this means that if you are not identifying a modification of gravity, then you could bias your inference. And this is the simple exercise that I'm doing here. So the y-axis is the masses, the x-axis is these modified gravity parameters, Cm. Here I say that in gray, the region where the peristability supernova gap is supposed to be. And then you can see, for example, that if gravity was modified to have like a negative Cm, and you were to analyze your data thinking that this is GR, then you will see signals which are very loud, but you will not you will think that they are closer. So they would need to have higher masses. So you would think that the peristability supernova gap is moving to higher masses. So there is an interplay between the inference of the masses of your source and the theory of gravity. Subodhi?
Yeah, hi, Jose. So yeah, so my question is regarding the shape you are considering. So you are making it assuming it will follow the dark energy ratio dependence.
Yes.
And what dependence are you taking there? How are you taking this dependence for which model?
So, if I'm presenting here the relation for the ratio of the luminosity distance, but you can translate this if you were to put the propagation equation, then I will be adding in the propagation equation in general relativity, you have H double dot, and then you have a term which comes from friction, but just from the Kabel expansion, and then you have CK squared. So what I'm adding with this modification is an extra friction. And then what I'm assuming is that this extra friction is proportional to the energy density of the dark energy, which I normalize to the present value. And then like this constant CM is the only parameter that tells you how much is the friction.
What I'm asking is basically that the ratio dependence can be different. I mean, for a wide range of theories, both the amplitude of CM and the Z dependence can be different.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm not claiming the opposite. So what I wanted to do like a kind of like an exercise. And then what the way I thought it is like, okay, typically if you want to explain the dark energy, you need to have a reason to have modified gravity. And then many people, the reason they have is to explain the cosmic expansion, the late time acceleration. And then if you want to explain that, typically you have something which kind of evolves with the dark energy. This is a behavior that you can see in some scalar tensor theories, but it's not like fully general. I agree with that, absolutely, yes.
Okay, thank
you. But that I think this doesn't change the point that you can go analyze your data and you can constrain it, but of course, like the particular constraints in the theory will change.
I mention this because this plot will this cutoffs you are putting is actually going to depend also on the shape of the curve you are considering. If you consider a ratio dependence which is different from dark energy, then these cutoffs for different CMs will also change.
Yes. Yeah. That's very true. So what I did is I took the latest catalog. I did a Bayesian inference allowing for this modification of gravity, and this is the contour plots of the most relevant parameters. Here CM, that you all now should be very familiar with it, and here we have also alpha. Alpha is the slope of the merger rate history, so it tells you like how fast the merger rate increases or decreases with redshift. And then M99 is the maximum mass of 99% of the bands. So you see here that there is this correlation between the maximum mass of your population and CM, as I was saying, and you have also some correlation between, you have some correlation between CM and the value of the slope of the merger rate history. I think beyond the particular details of what like population model you are using to parameterize your black holes, or what parametrization you are using to parameterize modified gravity, I think the important message here is that there is constraining power already in the data. And so, for example, doing this exercise, you find that the constraint on CM are almost an order of magnitude better than what you can do with 17 or 17. And what is relevant, what is important here to remember is that this only uses gravitational wave data. So if you want, it's a direct product of any catalog that we will have at any time. So it's kind of like something that this exercise you can always do. And I think that's something which is relevant and will become more interesting in the future as we increase our number of events. And then it will be interesting to also improve our modeling, allow, for example, for mass evolution of the mass distribution. So the other main predictions of general relativity is the fact that the dispersion relation of the gravitational wave is just CK. There is no dispersive terms. And also that you have only two tensor polarizations which propagate in the same way. Now, if you are thinking of being like fully general of what could happen in the propagation of gravitational waves when they travel across cosmological backgrounds, then the most general thing that could happen is that your gravitational wave interact also with other fields. So if your because here also I should mention, I'm assuming that there is no modification in the emission. We can discuss later about that, but for the moment I will focus that I will assume that the emission is like general relativity and see what happens in the propagation. So what I was saying is that in full generality, you could think, okay, my gravitational wave could interact with the other degrees of freedom of my modified gravity. Now, if you are in a Friedman-Robertson-Walker background, this means that you can only interact tensor modes with other tensor modes because there is this decoupling of scalar and vector and tensor perturbation, at least at leading order in perturbation theory. So one, the most general thing that you can consider for the propagation of gravitational wave beyond general relativity and in cosmological backgrounds is that you have these interactions with traditional fields. And you can have things like, for example, come in theories like by gravity, where you have two dynamical tensor fields. Then what you will end up with something schematically like this plot, like this equation, where you have a mixing of your tensor perturbation. H is the typical gravitational wave. S is the additional mode. And then you have a mixing through the mass matrix. And this is something which resembles very much what happens in neutrinos. So in neutrinos, you have also mixing in the mass matrix. And this means that as the neutrinos propagate, you are going to change the eigenstates of the propagation eigenstates are going to be different from the mass eigenstates. And this opens like a lot of possibilities, and you can have also mixings not only in the mass term, but you can also have in the friction term, and you could also have mixings which depends on the polarization. So really there are tons of possibilities. In this recent paper, we did an exploration of all of the possibilities, end up being a 70-page paper, so a ton of details, which I will not enter here. But what I think as a general theme, we identified that how the distortion that could happen on your signal depend on three relevant time scales. So essentially, what you want to identify first is you want to understand which are the eigenstates of the propagation eigenstate of your theory, and then this eigenstate could start interacting. So when they interact, then you can have interference pattern. And this is, for example, in the panel 2B is what you are seeing. You are seeing this beating pattern come from the fact that you have these two eigenstates which are interacting with each other. But then what can also happen is that each of the eigenstates could have a dispersion relation which is not equal to the one of general relativity, and then you will be distorting your waveform from there. And examples where you have this and you have also mixing is, for example, the third panel. Now, if you have different eigenstates and they have different propagation speeds, eventually your eigenstates will decohere. And then this is the other relevant time scale, because then when they decohere, you will be receiving echoes of your same signal, and each of your echo could also be distorted, for example, if you have a different dispersion relation for each of them. Shubhadeep?
Hi. Yeah. So can you please go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Right. So here I can consider this as a mass matrix, right? So the dimension of this quantity is like masses?
Yes.
So now if I, I'm not sure whether you are going to talk about that or not, but let's say I have W17.0817 from which I have constrained the mass value to some, I don't remember, less than some quantity we have already constrained.
Yes, the mass of the graviton, you mean?
That's right. So
yes,
putting that constraints together with this scenario, then how much allowed value of MH and MS are there?
Right. Yes. So for example, the first plot on the top here, this corresponds to a distortion induced by a massive graviton, right? So this is the case in which you are modifying the dispersion relation, adding a mass term, and then you have this modification. If you allow also for some of this interference effect, like for example in the panel 2B or 3, then you see that the signal is so much more different. So my expectation is that we can constrain, we have a lot of constraining power to constrain this type of interactions. However, we have not done the analysis. So we have in this paper, we have predicted what you should see. But I don't know if there is someone in the room who is expert in parameter estimation analysis. I think this is, there is a very clear project there on going and checking in the data if these distortions are in the data. I think from what we see, my impression is that the answer will be no. So then we could place constraints on this type of interactions, but we have not done the exercise ourselves. So I cannot give you a concrete number or answer to that. But my expectation is that indeed, I think we should be able to do, we should have relevant constraints. The other thing is that, which I think is interesting, for example, is that for given theories, you can have very concrete predictions, for example, on the echo. So this is the last panel. This corresponds to the case of bigravity. So in bigravity, you have effectively one massive and one massless mode. So the massless mode is the one that is to the left of time zero. And this one doesn't have any distortion because it's massless, so you don't have any dispersion relation. But then the other one, the massive one, is distorted. But what is interesting is that the time delay between the echoes is always rather small. So you should see the echo quite right after the data. So that's something that I think you can also go and constrain with the data. And there are some preliminary papers. So not preliminary. So there are some papers that analyze part of these effects. They didn't include fully all the details, but there are some papers that they did it with the first detections. But I think there is a lot to be improved in that respect.
Mm-hmm. So what is the value of M you have taken for these plots? Just one question. So what is the value of M you have taken? The mixing matrix values for these plots? Do you remember?
The value of what? Sorry.
The mixing matrix terms.
Yeah. So for example, the mass term that you need to have effects in the scales of LIGO, it should be of the order of 10 to the minus 22 electron volts or so. So that is larger than what LIGO constrains for the massive graviton, but you have to also be aware that this is a different scenario.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I think so the overall picture and message that I want to send is that with taking all these different tests together, we are going to be able to have a handle on all these on the very different branches of the modified gravity landscape. So there's been how much time is it okay? You said 45 minutes. There's been already a question. Is it okay if I continue five more minutes maybe or something?
That's fine. Yes. Yes, please.
Okay, great. Yeah, fantastic. So then for the last 5 minutes or so, I will tell you a little bit also on what you can do for lensing. And lensing becomes very relevant when you go to next generation detectors, because as you saw in the first slide, we are going to be able to move to much higher redshifts. And then the chances of seeing lensing increase dramatically. Now, one of the first questions that you can ask yourself is but what will be different from gravitational waves to electromagnetic radiation? And a first point is that gravitational waves, they have wavelengths which has an astrophysical size. So this means that they will encounter astrophysical objects on their way, and there could be it will be more frequent to have wave effects. So this is a completely new area that I will not talk in this in the rest of the talk, but I think it's important to have in mind that with gravitational wave effects become much more relevant. The other important thing is that is to realize that when we are doing when we have our gravitational wave detectors, we are really doing all sky surveys. So we are surveying all the sky at all the time. Well, there is the antenna pattern of our detectors that some areas we detect better and others worse, but essentially we are detecting all the sky at the same time. And this is very interesting if you want to do like a statistical analysis of the population of lenses, for example, because then if you are doing that, this is better than with electromagnetic surveys, where you only have small patches in the sky. And moreover, with gravitational wave, we understand very well our selection effects and detector sensitivity. So we know very well when and why we are detecting a signal. And for some searches of lensing, sometimes this can be more tricky with electromagnetic radiation. The negative side of gravitational waves is that our localization is rather poor. So, for example, like seeing like angular separation between images is something that is beyond any prospect. But we detect the signals coherently, and we are then sensitive to the phase, and that's something that it can be very relevant, as I will explain next. So let's focus on the case in which we are in the limit of a strong lensing, that is when a gravitational wave travels close enough to a massive lens so that it generates multiple images. So in this limit of a strong lensing, then the amplification factor, how each of the signal changes, will be essentially determined by three terms. On blue is the magnification, which is tells you if your signal is being amplified or demagnified. And then this is something which affects directly your luminosity distance, in the same way as modified gravity was doing before. Then, of course, because each of the signals travels in a different path and they feel a different gravitational potential, there will be a different arrival times. So you can also use the information on the arrival time to constrain the lens model. But finally, there is also a term which is a constant phase shift, which depends on the type of image. If you have a type 1 image, then you don't have a phase shift. But if you have a type 2, you have a pi half shift. And if you have a type 3, you have a pi shift. And then, as I was saying, with gravitational waves, you are sensitive to the phase and the shape of the time domain signal. So you are sensitive to this term. So if you were to have only one frequency mode, then this frequency independent phase shift will be completely degenerated with other parameters of your binary. But if you have multiple frequency modes, as for example, if you have a binary with asymmetric masses, you have, well, in general, you always have multiple frequency modes, but I was implicitly thinking of relevant multiple frequency modes. If you have multiple of those, then this frequency independent phase shift, what is going to make is going to introduce a frequency dependent time delay. So you are going to shift in time differently each of the higher modes, what means that overall your signal is distorted. So the punchline of this is that lens gravitational waves, particular type 2 images, can differ from the predictions of unlensed general relativity waveforms. And that is very interesting, because then if you see these distortions, you can identify as them being lens. And an example of that is in this plot for asymmetric masses, but I think I'm gonna skip on the details. Just to say that this, when you compute, for example, the signal-to-noise loss by not using the right template, because you of course you can ask, okay, but can I not really mimic this effect with some of the parameters of my binary? And when you have higher modes, you cannot do that. And the loss in your signal-to-noise, if you are just using general and lens general relativity waveforms, increases as you decrease the mass ratio, or you make your binaries with one heavier and one lighter. So these differences in the signal-to-noise, this signal-to-noise loss is small, which means that for typical binaries that we are seeing so far, our templates work fine. So if we were to have a lens signal, we are going to detect it. So that's something which is also good to know, like we are not going to miss the signal just because of this distortion. But this also means that in particular in the future, as we improve our sensitivities, then we can identify this distortion and single out that they were lens. So far, within the LIGO and VIGO collaboration, because all the typical events doesn't have, like many of them, they don't have strong evidence for higher modes or precession or eccentricity, then what we look for overlaps in the parameters. Because if there are no distortions in the waveform, it means that your inference of the masses, your inference of the spins, your inference of the sky localization should be the same for each of the lens images. So you can go to your data and look, okay, do I have pairs which have overlapping parameters? And in fact, there are pairs which have overlapping parameters, but then when you make a more detailed analysis and introduce our understanding of the population of lenses, the typical time delays that we expect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, at the end, what we see is that indeed, we don't find any evidence of lensing so far, but this is also expected, but it will change in the future. So in this plot, this is done by a Fei Xu, a student at UC Chicago. This is the rate of lensing as a function of the velocity dispersion. So this is just changing the typical masses of your lenses. What we expect for galaxy lensing is to have a velocity dispersion between 161 and 200, more or less. So you see that now with current sensitivities, the orange line, we are below one detection per year. So it's kind of like expected that we haven't seen something yet. But as we move to design sensitivity, the red line, and especially when we go to third generation detectors, we will see a strong lensing for sure. And this is something which is interesting to constrain the properties of the lenses. Subodip has also worked on that. You can learn about the properties of the lenses and also the properties of your binaries. And then the last thing that I wanted to say, without entering into the details, is that also with lensing, you can even get deeper constraints into modified gravity, because then you are no longer in a regime where you can only interact with tensor modes. You can also have your gravitational waves could mix with other modes. For example, in a scalar tensor theory, you could mix with scalar modes. And that is very interesting, because then you are changing the polarization content. And then your signal, when you detect it, it could be a scramble and it could have echoes, but also could have a polarization content which is different from GR. And that's something which is very interesting from the data analysis perspective. So overall, I've covered three topics that I think will be very important for the next generation detectors. For cosmology, I focus on the case of far-sight binaries as good candidates to do cosmology and very relevant multiband events for LIS and ground-based detectors. With gravity, we've seen that even without counterparts, you can do population analysis to constrain the luminosity distance, which is something really interesting. And there is plenty of work to do in terms of constraining mixings of different tensor modes in the future. Finally, for lensing, I think one of the main messages that I want to say is that you can, since there is this possible distortion in the signal, you could identify lensing just with a single image, strong lensing, which is very cool. And also the fact that we should all be aware that the first detection of lensing could be arriving very soon. So this is all from my side. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Jose, for a wonderful talk. We had quite a number of questions already during the talk, but I see there's more questions here. Bruce has his hands up.
Hola, Jose, gracias.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
I have a question about the echoes that you mentioned with respect to lensing. So what you're calling echoes, so it's not a signal that bounce and come back. It's just, it's the lensing, right? That one will arrive at one point and then another one in a different path will arrive at a slightly different
one. Exactly. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Has anyone done, so in principle, depending on the extension of GR1 is considering, you could have something that is on all the time, or the effect, it's only relevant when the signal passes close enough of a strongly gravitating body. So in the whatever the picture you have in mind, you're considering the former, where it will be an effect that will be there from source to observer, because otherwise the effect would be extremely tiny, right?
Yes, right. So that's very, yeah. So, I mean, there are many possibilities. So something which I think is very cool of this scenario is if you, for example, in the case in which you have a binary orbiting a supermassive black hole, because then you have like the lens like super close by the to your emitter, and then you can have an effect which is very large. That's something which has not been we did propose it, but has not been like fully explored yet in detail. But it's an excellent thing. Another thing also related to echoes that I didn't mention is that, for example, I was mentioning for the case of mixing, not in the case of lensing, but with tensor modes just in a cosmological background, then the regime in which you have echoes will depend on the redshift. So it will be different in the sense that you could see like kind of like a low redshift population where there are no echoes, and then your high redshift population where there are echoes. And of course, then you would say, okay, this might look like a standard lensing of general relativity, but then of course the properties of the time delays distribution will be very different. So that's a way in which you can distinguish both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More questions? Juan?
I have a question regarding exactly this slide. So you mentioned you want to use lensing to test GR, but the lens events are a small fraction of like all the events, right? Like would it be easier to test GR using the normal events?
Yeah. Thank you very much for your question, because I went so fast here that I didn't emphasize something which is very important, which is that here you see in this diagram, there is this RE, which is supposed to be the Einstein radius, and there is this R star, which is supposed to be like the typical scale in which you have a modified gravity effects are relevant. So the fact that depending on your theory of modified gravity, this R star can be larger or smaller than the Einstein radius, which means that, so in this case, I'm choosing the example in which it's smaller, so you will need to be in a strong lensing to detect this effect, and then you are right that it's a very small, the fraction is already very small. But then if R star is larger than the Einstein radius, this means that the probability of this to happen is larger than lensing. So I think we didn't go into the details of many particular theories, but I think that should be an exercise easy to make. If you have a given theory, you should be able to compute what is the relevant scale for lensing of your theory. And then if it is larger than the Einstein radius, is something which also is interesting, because it will be more probable. But thanks a lot for the question.
Okay, thank you.
Did you have a question?
Yes. I was just curious about this lensing also. So you mentioned how there are these extra like Morse phases, you know,
yes,
relative between like, you know, the odd and even parity images.
Yes.
So you mentioned how this can lead to also like distortions in like the waveforms between those even and odd images, right?
Yes.
And so normally in the geometric optics limit of lensing, right, you know, so when you have these two images that approach each other on the sky, then they have these, you know, simple universality relations. And so I was just wondering if these extra Morse phases do anything to those simple relations.
So I'm not so sure of what universal relations you are referring to.
Oh, okay, yeah. So for example, right, so if you have two images that occur very close together on the sky,
yes,
you know, for example, for example, in like a fold catastrophe, right, you know, so the brightnesses of the two images you know, become very close to each other, for example.
Okay.
Yeah, anyway, well, right, you know, I was just curious, you know, if these extra, you know, phase shifts that you're talking about, if they do anything interesting to those, you know, standard predictions that we do in the geometric optics limit.
Yes, so something that I didn't mention here, but we studied, is very relevant in electromagnetic lensing, is the case of the massive degeneracy, for example. Mm-hmm. And that in that case, we were trying to see if this phase shift could be enough to break the degeneracy. And what we found is that at the end, it is not very efficient. You can break down the massive degeneracy if you have if you enter in the regime of wave optics, because then you have you can have larger distortions. But within the strong lensing regime, these were not enough. But I cannot think now of any of the implications for other predictions, like the one of the brightness as you are saying. But that's something that might be. I'll think more about that. That's an interesting point that I didn't think before.
Okay, great. Thanks.
More questions or comments? I was actually wondering for your beyond GR waveforms, how do you compute those waveforms?
Right. So I mean, as I said, for us, we are always in the assumption that the emission is not modified. So then it's very simple because we have an analytical prediction for what the propagation does. So if you want, we have a transfer function. So we can put this transfer function to the GR initial waveform, and then you get the plots that I was showing here. So that these plots all come from that assumption. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I think Reed has a question.
Yeah, thanks, Jose. Actually, it's about this plot as well. Is the claim in this paper that you guys have enumerated all possible propagation effects, or just considered a couple and then all combinations of those couples? My point is, if I'd looked at that paper and read it in detail, would I be able to build a waveform model that contained all possible deviations to the propagation effects?
Or I think so. What we did not in the, so the thing is so you have two eigenstates, and then each of the eigenstates can get modified, and then also this eigenstate can interact with each other, and then they also can decouple in the decoherence regime. So in this this is meant to be more or less all the possible regimes, this plot, but then of course there can be different particular modifications, or the scales in which you have distortions in one of the eigenstates and in the other can be different. So I think in the paper we identify all the relevant scales, and we have the formulae to compute this transfer function. But then there could be more different distortion to what is plotted here. Okay. But yeah, I mean. Well, if you attempt to read the paper, also let me know, and I will point you to relevant places, because it's kind of long, so I can help you with that. And yeah, but I do think there is a lot of work to use this really fully constrain the modification in the cosmological propagation of gravitational waves.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Any final questions? Okay, if not, then let's thank Jose again.
Thanks to you. It was really, really nice. I like a lot the lively discussion. It was really good.